welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which helps people with cancer to find out how they can support their own well-being and recovery. This week, my guest for the show is a pioneer in broadening the scope of cancer care. I'm fortunate to have interviewed many of my heroes from the early days of Yes to Life, those who paved the way for our work during the previous 20 years, names such as Michael Lerner, Dr. Keith Block, Ralph Moss, Patria King and Bernie Siegel. Ian Gawler has been working since the 80s with patient support groups in Australia. He's also an author of many well-respected books for those with cancer. He has an extraordinary personal story to tell, as well as a vast store of accumulated wisdom to share. I'm speaking to Ian over the internet in Australia. Hi Ian, and a big welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Thanks Robin, pleasure to have a chance to talk to you.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be talking to someone whose name has been familiar since the very early days of Yes to Life via your first book, You Can Conquer Cancer. It was always on our shelves, but by the time we started, it had already been in print for 20 years. First published 1984, I understand. So
that's correct.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm really grateful to another very long-term player in the field from your side of the planet, Patria King, for introducing me to you. She's someone else, of course, with a truly remarkable cancer experience. So yours is a really captivating story in its mix of mind, body and spirit approaches to a very serious cancer situation. It's the sort of thing we're more familiar with these days since the advent of the internet and along with the work of Dr. Kelly Turner and her Radical Remission Programme, and indeed your own books document large numbers of remarkable recoveries now. But back then, although they were obviously still occurring, we didn't get to hear about them so much. Your recovery stories such as yours, they've always been met with a few standard responses from the mainstream, such as, oh, well, the diagnosis was flawed, he never really had cancer in the first place, or the one dose of chemo he had 2 years before recovering was clearly very effective. I'm guessing you've had your share of this. How have you managed to preserve and support the remarkable status of your recovery over the years?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, and it probably is worth actually going back to those early days. I was diagnosed with a osteogenic sarcoma, bone cancer in my right leg in 1975. And at the time I was a young veterinarian, so I had a pretty good working knowledge of things medical. And in fact, I'd amputated animals' legs that had these similar sorts of cancers in them, and seeing the cancer reappear with monotonous regularity fairly quickly and then being completely stuck for anything else to help those animals with. So when I got into that same situation myself and had my leg amputated in 1975, I had the experience of the cancer coming back before the end of 75 and being told that there was nothing modern medicine of the day could do for me except palliative care. And basically they told me I'd live 3 to 6 months and come back when things got grim and I could be looked after as I died. I didn't feel that, I didn't find that offer particularly appealing.
No.
and I was probably fortunate enough to be silly enough to think maybe there was a way to get well. Because I think without that, I wouldn't have. I mean, if I'd accepted the opinion of medicine of the day, which, you know, was well informed and caring and trying to work to my best interest, but if I'd accepted that there was nothing that I could do, then I've got no doubt I would have died on time. But as it was, I thought, well, having been a young veterinarian and worked with animals for a couple of years, I'd already developed a really strong appreciation for animals' capacity to heal themselves. And actually the dean of my year in veterinary science, when we started, told his young students that in all likelihood Of all the animals that came to us, probably 85% of them would get well without us doing anything. So we shouldn't interfere too much. And,
Perceptive man.
yes. And so I had that sort of background, and I thought, well, maybe there's some way that I can help my own capacity for healing to sort of come to the fore and contribute to a recovery. And so that led me into looking at nutrition intensively, to the power of the mind, and to meditation and all those allied things. So I was very much around in those pioneering days of what we now call complementary therapies, or I'd prefer to call lifestyle medicine, actually, using things like nutrition and your mind as part of your lifestyle and a way of actually recovering from significant illness. And in the event, I had quite a lot of ups and downs, and I did have some medical treatment, and I did recover. And I remember very clearly going back to several of my original treating doctors and say, "Hey, look at this. I'm still alive."
And
And I think I got some understanding of how come I survived. And the reaction was totally perplexing to me, totally perplexing. Because instead of being curious, they got angry with me. And they sort of challenged me to say, "Well, your diagnosis must have been wrong. There must have been some mistake, or there's no way that changing your diet could have helped you at all. You must have just been lucky." It was a bit offensive, really, and very unscientific. So it's really good to see how things have changed in the subsequent nearly 50 years, and how slowly, steadily, there's been a recognition that nutrition's important, that the mind's clearly important, that meditation's got a big role to play, and all these other things. So it's been good to have survived long enough to see the changing place of these things in the community.
Absolutely. It makes you wonder, though, whether the pace of change in that way of an expanding view is moving fast enough to keep up with cancer, which of course is expanding in terms of incidence so rapidly now. We need some good answers, don't we?
Well, I think, to be blunt, we know what they are. The majority of cancers are lifestyle related, and you see the impact of people who develop cancer changing their lifestyle and how it helps their health and their well-being and their prospects of recovering greatly. But clearly, if people were to make those same changes in advance of getting sick, it would so much the better.
Absolutely.
I think that's the real message that comes out of it. People sometimes say, "Well, I was clever to recover," but I think I would have been even cleverer if not to got sick in the first place. And I don't want to say that to sort of imply any sort of sense of shame or blame on people who get sick, because what makes us sick has lots of causes and factors. And clearly, I've been down that road myself. But clearly, when you look at all the chronic degenerative diseases, of which cancer is one of the major ones, they're all heavily lifestyle related. And it's absolutely clear, if we could take the message from people who've had to suffer these illnesses, we'd be actually putting a lot more effort, both personally and within our communities and with government, to actually improving our lifestyles.
Yeah, it's got to be the way to go. Prevention is definitely what we need rather than treatment. You're right. Okay, so it was obviously clear right from the start that conventional medicine didn't have that much on offer for you, and under their care, the chances of any sort of life were vanishingly small. So I can imagine this had two effects on you, one of being hugely challenging on a spiritual level, but also of placing any hopes that you may have had firmly outside the mainstream. So I'm interested to hear how you met the challenge and where you did look for inspiration and direction.
Good questions. So there's two of them. The first one is to do with, you know, facing this existential threat, I guess, you know, the prospect of an untimely and probably pretty painful death. And look, I think if I reflect back on that time, I think there's no doubt what helped me most was actually facing the prospect that I could actually die. So I didn't deny that real possibility. And I actually went into it and I did what I could, because it all happened pretty quickly. I did what I could in the short space of time I had to accept that possibility and do what I could to be ready for it. Yeah, to be blunt, you know, externally in terms of life and things like wills and stuff like that, it was very rudimentary because I just didn't have much time. But internally, there was a deep recognition that death was real and could be imminent and could happen any old time, an acceptance of that. But then at the same time, a really strong commitment to do everything I could to recover. And importantly, there was no stage through that process where I actually genuinely thought I was going to die. There was a lot of time where I thought I could die. You know, I got down to about 4.5 stone at my, my worst. So I lost a heck of a lot of weight. I'm 6'2" and... in the old measure, and I'd been a decathlon athlete and very fit, so you know I got really sick, and I got very close. And my surgeon, who was probably the most open-minded of the doctors I was involved with in those days, told me afterwards that he thought I'd got within a couple of weeks of dying, early 76. I think the recognition that death was real and possible, accepting that, and then using the energy around that actually to really motivate full commitment to everything else that I was doing, actually.
Interesting. I'd love to just go into that a little bit more, because it seems to me that we've moved from a place where everybody used to be in La La Land and pretend and not use the word cancer and tell people, oh, you'll be fine, all that sort of thing. You know, doctors never told people what was going on. Sure. We moved from there. We seem to go almost immediately into a completely the opposite end of the spectrum, which is like, right, you've got 3 months, you might as well start packing up your staff. You know, you're out of here. This sort of blunt, blank, uncaring prognosis, which applies to populations, but not necessarily to you. And you there took a rather different course, which embraced two things at the same time. You embraced the real possibility of your death, so there's not the la-la land, but you also took on the strong intention to do everything you could to live. So you didn't sit there and accept that you're going to die at all, which a lot of people do. They're told they're going to die, and you use the phrase, you would have died on time, which is exactly what happens to a lot of people. They simply, they get depressed, they give up. You know, it's like it's a death sentence, just like that. So this actually accommodating two things which sort of seem to not fit together in some ways gave you the power and strength to move forward in a way which you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, I would say, I'm suggesting. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, absolutely, Robin. I mean, I'd characterise it sort of very simply as saying it involves acceptance and commitment. Acceptance of the possibilities and commitment to doing what you can to make the best of the situation, accepting things as they are. You know, it's no doubt I was critically ill for quite a period of time. And if at any stage I think I had bought into that notion that this was going to kill me and taken it on genuinely, I think I would have declined and died pretty quickly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Look, I started running cancer support groups based on this sort of lifestyle approach in 1981. And as you say, in those days, medicine was coming out of the period where they hadn't told people with cancer what they were dealing with. And in fact, one of my uncles had that experience. He developed a leukemia, and his wife was told that they were going to tell him he had a liver complaint. And it wasn't until the last day of his life that he and his wife could actually talk about the reality of his situation. And it really traumatized her, having to keep that secret for so many years. When we started running groups, medicine had changed and decided that that wasn't the way to go, and this sort of blunt realism was better. So people were being told very literally and very bluntly, and often with the perception on the patient's part that there was a coldness in it, sort of this real clinically detached, yeah, you've got 3 to 6 months to live and there's nothing we can do. The people who told me weren't actually cold about it, but they were definitive. And, you know, when you talk, do you know the pointing of the bone effect in the UK? Do you talk about that?
No.
The pointing of the bone's a fascinating reality for Australian Aboriginals, First Nations people. And, you know, in their traditional lives, they were very close-knit societies, and often, like particularly in Central Australia where the conditions were so harsh, they had quite strict laws that kept their communities together and enabled things to work. And there were various punishments that ranged up to the most severe of them actually being the pointing of the bone. And what would happen is if somebody broke a law, because they were in these tight communities, everybody knew that they'd broken the law, including the perpetrator. And what would happen was that they would have what they called a man of high degree, which was, you know, like a witch doctor, but we wouldn't use that word, but it gives people who are not familiar with this the idea of it. A senior law holder, they would actually carry out this ritual called pointing the bone. And they used a human thigh bone, a femur, as the bone. And in the ritual, the man of high degree would point the bone at the offender and basically tell them that he was going to die. And there'd be no physical connection. It was all in the mind. And then once that had happened, the whole community that surrounded this fellow or woman would withdraw, and the person would go into a rapid decline. And it's happened in modern times, and modern medicine sort of put people on drips and tried to keep them alive, but they die anyway. And when the person got close to dying, then all the family and relatives and the community would come around and almost sort of supervise their death. So if you compare that to a bad prognosis given badly, it's got all the same features. You've got the the man of high degree or the woman of high degree dresses up in a white coat, stethoscope round their neck, person in authority who says, this is what's going to happen to you. The ritual often involves things like tests and CAT scans and one thing and another. And, you know, they get put up on a wall and see, this is how it's going to happen. And back in those days too, particularly, people didn't really know how to relate to people with cancer very well. So the communities would withdraw from these people because they were often worried about saying or doing the wrong thing. So the person would go into this isolated state, and then when they got critically ill, everybody would come around to say goodbye. So you've got all those same elements there.
Amazing. Yes, you're right. Yeah, it's just like it.
That's pointing of the bone. So when we started running groups in 81, we had a lot of people who coming, suffering from that effect. And the effect was basically a profound sense of hopelessness and inevitability about this illness going to be the cause of their death. So when we were able to say to them, well, actually, there are other possibilities, and reawaken hope, the effect was dramatic. And I mentioned that with pointing of the bone, in the traditional Aboriginal society, people have gone into hospitals. Where they have actually reversed it is where somebody who the person who's been pointed gives a status of authority to has been able to come up with a ritual to convince the person who's been pointed that it's actually been reversed. And in that situation, people have recovered. So I think we saw a lot of people actually reversing the effect of a bad prognosis being given badly, and this surge of hope resulting in actually a marked upturn in all their physical and markers and markers of well-being, state of mind. It was dramatic.
Yeah. Well, I think of Helpline as doing a very similar job. We get a lot of people that, you know, just managed to call our Helpline, but actually they're in a horrible place of hopelessness. And, you know, you only need to give one little tiny shred of something in the future for them to work towards, and then something else, and then something else. And in no time at all, they can get motoring again and get their life force back.
And that's why I was very happy to talk with you, because, you know, I think one of the most powerful ways to do that is through people sharing their stories. That's one of the things you do regularly on your podcast. And I'm in my own experience, you know, having worked with thousands of people, it's the, you know, the research is interesting, but it's, you know, pretty dry, and you can always argue over research. But people's stories are commanding. And when people share their stories, the humanity comes across, and it's inspiring. And it can make a really significant shift in people's state of mind.
Absolutely. And I was thinking the common factor between those two polar opposite states of the medical world of denial or blunt truth is that they both avoid any vulnerability on the part of the practitioner, the clinician.
I wonder about that. I think both are really tough, actually.
I agree they're tough. The whole situation is tough, yeah.
You know, having had the experience of being a veterinarian and, you know, having to have similar conversations with owners about their animals, and having been through, you know, having worked, come out of the vet school, worked for a couple of years, then had my own critical illness and then got going back to work, it really changed my perspective on how to talk with clients, you know.
Interesting.
Call our owners clients, you know, how to talk to people about these very personal, very emotive issues, and to be able to observe the difference in how it felt for me, you know, when I was young and a bit brash before I got really ill, you know, it takes a lot of energy to actually deal with it that way. Whereas to be open, I think it's harder to get to the place where you can have the confidence to be open and to be more expressive and to allow people's emotions in a little. But actually, it leads to much better relationships and I think probably better outcomes.
I think absolutely agree with you there.
Yeah, and we all remember the old, we all sort of speak wonfully, if that's the right word, about the old style GP, you know, who would put their hand on your shoulder and speak to you with comfort. And, you know, it probably didn't matter what they did as far as the prescription, you went away feeling better. Yeah, and these days the GPs, bless them, you know, my wife's a GP, it's really tough, you know, that for a start they're worried about where they can put their hands.
Right.
And for a second thing, they're spending so much time looking at their computers and sending people off for tests rather than doing clinical exams and relating to them personally. It's, you know, clearly there's a spectrum here, just as there are in oncologists. And, you know, I think it's terrific to observe that some oncologists have really worked this stuff out and there's much more training around on how to actually manage these issues. But you still probably hear too many bad stories about the lack of communication skills in people who, you know, could be trained to do it much better.
Yep. Okay. Well, look, basically at that point you were trying a lot of things. They were, you know, covered, as you've already said, you were looking at meditation, you're looking at your diet, various things you were trying. But I understand that whereas you got yourself to a state where you were feeling a lot better, actually your cancer was still marching on quite unhindered. But you then changed gear, if you like, and got into actions which did actually start to have an effect. Do you want to just talk about what changed in you and what it was you did different that had this effect?
Yeah, I think there's probably two things worth talking about, and it feels a bit weird sort of talking about yourself, but I guess that's the deal.
Par for the course,
in the conversation. So I think there were two elements in my character that helped a lot. And one is I can be very focused. So when I did things, I was completely engaged. You know, I'd had a long history of being a decathlon athlete. So I was used to training hard and putting up with difficulty and persevering.
Mm-hmm.
And also the decathlon's a lovely event because you get 10 goes at putting together a decent result. It's not just like if you do 100 metres and you stuff it up, you've got no recourse. So, you know, in decathlon you tend to be pretty good at everything but not particularly good at anything. And I think that sort of reflects me a little. But it meant that when I took things on, I was, you know, I was 100%. I didn't do anything half-heartedly. But also the other quality that helped was I wasn't fixated. So I was prepared to stand back from time to time and say, is this working? Is this actually helping me or not? And as you point out, I managed to survive past my initial six-month departure date when I was diagnosed with secondaries. And I was feeling really well, actually. I had a lot of energy and I put weight back on and everything was going well, but the cancers themselves were actually getting to be quite large. And so I went back to my medical people and asked what was around or if there was any other possibilities. And this was when chemotherapy first came to Australia, actually. So I was one of the very first people to have experimental chemotherapy, particularly for my condition. And it was proposed that I have a two-year course. And I thought, well, that's pretty optimistic. I've gone from 3 to 6 months to 2 years.
Right, yeah, okay.
But it came with a real raft of potential side effects, which included becoming sterile. And I've had 4 children since, so that one didn't sort of live to fruition.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
I decided to take on this chemotherapy because nothing else seemed to be tipping the balance for me. And I thought also, having a veterinary background, having something that was strongly medical might actually help my head to get into gear a bit better and have a bit more conviction in the recovery. And in the event, I only had about 10 weeks of treatment. And then, so another feature was I responded to my own inner voice, if I can put it that way. I was doing a lot of meditation, so I had quite a lot of mental clarity from that. And I seemed to have a really good sense of whether things were working or not. And I felt like the chemotherapy I had helped me for a couple of months and was worthwhile. And then after that, I just felt really strongly that whatever benefit it could give me, I'd received. And if I had more, it was just going to add to the risk of side effects and be counterproductive. So against medical advice, I actually stopped it. And
Interesting.
I say that to doctors and they get nervous. But
yeah, you do.
In actual fact, it worked out well for me.
And so that was an intuitive decision, you would say.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. And then I kept on really with the intense sort of program that I'd been following, and it was probably another 18 months later that I was found to be all clear in 78.
Okay, so...
And I've been well since.
What happened in between those two times then?
What, between stopping the chemo and...
Yeah, and being given the all clear.
Well,
you still had plenty of evidence of disease when the chemo was stopped, presumably.
I did the dietary side of things very intensively. I was meditating 3 hours a day, doing all that sort of stuff, exercising and, following the whole program, basically. Very much along the lines of what's in my cancer book, You Can Conquer Cancer.
Okay. So you're basically continuing your program but ramping it up somewhat.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Yeah. So you kind of intuitively felt, well, okay, the chemo has slowed things down to give you a chance, if you like. It slowed down the progress of your cancer. But was it actually measurably less?
It was. And I'm a bit of a chronicler too, so I photographed. When some of these cancers that I had were actually visible on my sternum, the front of my chest. So I was keeping a photographic record of them, which turned out to be really helpful because I took a photograph on the first of every month. And each month came around, I thought, oh, they got worse. And I'd take a photograph and they were actually marginally better. So it was really encouraging. There was a small decrease over those couple of months that I had the chemo, and then it just kept going. Yeah, so some of the medicos would say I just got a good long prolonged benefit from the chemo, and maybe that was it. But maybe that was I got that benefit because I supported it with all the other things that I was doing. And it's worth pointing out that they don't use that protocol that I was treated with anymore for osteogenic sarcoma.
No. It's interesting. With cancer, I've come to feel that it's something that has momentum. And, you know, you can have a cancer that's not got much momentum, and probably you can control the whole thing with lifestyle alone, and that's that.
Yeah.
But if you've got a cancer that's got a lot of momentum, it's progressing fast, the chances are that it needs a knock on the head. And this is where conventional medicine excels, I think, actually,
sure.
to stopping it in its tracks for a while and giving you the opportunity to bring in all the other things. And, you know, you seem to me you've described something very like that, where it had lots of momentum in one direction and you weren't managing to slow it down particularly, but the chemo just changed that. It went over the top and started going downhill.
Yeah.
And then you were able to get in there and, you know, you're using similar approaches, you said before, but they were actually working much better for you.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So you also did a bit of world touring at that time, which was all part of the same journey, I think. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, I mean, I we could talk a lot about it because it was pretty fascinating. I went to the Philippines and checked out the faith healers there, and I went to India and got some very real assistance from a major spiritual leader in India. Maybe it's best to talk about that one because I can summarize the impact of that probably more easily and in a more accessible way.
I
went to
great.
India, and when I went there, I really felt I was doing all the things that were necessary to get well. But the thing that was holding me back was my own thinking processes and the doubts I had about it. So from the outside, I would have appeared to be a very positive person. You know, I was really had clear goals and was following them through pretty thoroughly. And I was enjoying doing it. I had all those sort of basic principles going. But internally, there were quite deep nagging doubts. Is this really going to work for me? I knew it could work in theory. I knew it could work for other people. But was it really going to work for me? So I went to India in that sort of frame of mind, and I met up with this Indian spiritual leader, Sai Baba, and in an interview, he said to me very, very simply, he said, "You're already healed, don't worry." Now,
sounds like the opposite of pointing the bone to me.
Yes, yeah, and because of his authority, and because of that whole construct that led up to that, all the circumstances that led up to that, the atmosphere of being in India, the whole thing, that really hit home. And I must say, having gone there, I was hoping for some sort of like profound mystical experience, you know, a few flashing lights and bells and whistles
right.
would have been nice. But in the event, I mean, it was clear to me this man was an extraordinary spiritual leader, and his presence was remarkable, you know, very much in line with what people experience when they meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I imagine. And then these words, "You're already healed, don't worry," it actually took a couple of days to seep in. So it wasn't like an instantaneous sort of clunk. It was more like over a couple of days, I just came to a really clear appreciation that actually I was going to get well, it was going to work for me. And I feel like from that point on, which was probably still about a year before I was clear of cancer, just everything I did was potentiated by this conviction. So in broader terms, there was a movement from belief, you know, believing that something was possible, to faith or conviction that 100% it was going to happen.
How interesting.
And I think when the mind puts itself to something with total conviction, then, you know, that's when really extraordinary things happen.
Well, look, I think that's so great. Thank you very much for that story. We just had our annual conference here in the UK, which we called Finding a Deeper Connection. So this really was going into this kind of territory, if you like, your, you know, fundamental relationship to life, where you're placing your faith, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just great to hear you describe just how central this was to your recovery, and the fact you're still here today, decades later, looking very solid and as though you're completely comfortable about being here. And it kind of exposes that how doubtful and ambiguous we all are underneath it generally. If we don't examine things, we just think, oh yeah, you know, I want to be here, I want to be alive, of course I do. But until we're put on the spot, really, like you were, this is not tested, of course. And you can find out there's some big holes in there.
Yeah. Well, in You Can Conquer Cancer, I start off by asking a few questions. And interestingly, directly related to what you're saying, the first one is I suggest to people that they look into themselves and say, do I really want to get well again?
Right.
Because I think for some people, actually, and you know, I'm talking very generally, you know, for some people, cancer comes at a time when they're really worn down by life. And in a way, it almost gives a way out that's honourable. I think for many people, it does cause them to reflect deeply on their life, you know, its meaning and purpose and who they are and what they really want out of life. And, you know, I'd be one of many people I've met who reflect back on their journey through cancer with a sense of gratitude. I feel really fortunate. Actually, I got cancer rather than a heart attack.
Right.
Heart attacks aren't a very useful illness, actually, because they either kill you on the spot or you recover, and people just go back to whatever they were doing. They might reflect for a day or two, but most don't. Whereas cancer actually interrupts your life so thoroughly, and your family and friends around you, it really causes you to think about what's important, what do I value and what do I want to do. And I don't think anybody would wish it on themselves or invite it. But I haven't met anybody who got excited about a cancer diagnosis because it was going to teach them about life.
No.
But I've met lots of people, you probably have too, who after years' involvement with cancer say that getting diagnosed with cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them. And that seems extraordinary to the uninitiated, as it were, but that's the reality of it, that it's the sort of disease that causes you to question everything from what you're doing physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And if you take it seriously, it can really enliven your life. It can really add to the meaning and the quality of your life dramatically.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, that's pretty much the words I opened our conference with about, you know, the best thing that ever happened in my life. I've met far too many people who say that for it to be a coincidence, you know. And it doesn't make any sense at all to most people, as you say. I mean, it's and of course it's not a reason to wish cancer on anybody, but it you know, it can turn something which on the scale of things is a total nightmare in every possible way. Cancer, there's nothing very good about cancer at all in itself. It can turn that into this potential platform to propel you into another life. And to find ways to help people to do that, which is clearly what you've been doing all these years, and which we were having our little go at with our conference, is a wonderful thing to at least attempt to do, I think, because it's like night and day to be a somebody who's a victim of cancer or somebody who's actually been reborn from cancer, if you like.
Yes. I ended up working with a fellow who was diagnosed with a reasonably difficult cancer on his 40th birthday. And he had a friend who was a naturopath, and he rang up the naturopath to tell him the news. And the naturopath said, oh, he said, that's fantastic. He said, that's the best birthday present you could ever have. And my friend was so angry.
I bet.
He was so annoyed. And I think he remained annoyed because it turned out to be true, of course. And he ended up working in the foundation I was involved with, and was a terrific therapist. But yeah, I think you've got to be fairly careful when you start having that conversation.
A little bit of diplomacy is needed. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to tell anybody that it's the best thing that's ever happened to them, really. They need to find that out for themselves.
Yeah, probably. But I think that's, again, where stories help so much, Robin. You know, like if people read these stories or hear stories, then you see, well, actually, yeah, there is you know, proverbial light at the end of the tunnel, that you do hear about how people turn their lives around. And again, when people are talking from their own personal experience, that can have a really deep impact and can be inspiring and help people to have that shift from, you know, despair and hopelessness to a real sense of, I can make something out of this.
Mm. Well, very interesting. Again, in my talk at the introduction, I was alluding to the fact that this, I did hope that that's what the conference was going to bring to people, bring some confidence and direction to them. Well, first of all, did you say you've got to accommodate the fact that it's possible, and you were already in that position, you say, but then there's a big step from there, is it's possible for me. They're not the same thing at all, are they? And, you know, this kind of disease of self-doubt that we all share as a race, you know, well, not quite all, but most of us share that deep self-doubt and division. It undermines those kind of things and makes us feel that, okay, these things happen to a few very exceptional people, but that's not me, is it?
Yeah, and I think, again, that's where patient-related or patient-inspired, patient-driven groups are so useful.
Right.
Because these are the things that they can actually share and promulgate.
Yeah, we had our keynote speaker was a man called Steve Taylor, who's a researcher. He's a lecturer in psychology, but he's an author, and his particular interest is in transformational experiences. And he's done a massive amount of research, talked to loads of people who've had their lives transformed through all sorts of bad experiences, basically. He calls it transformation through turmoil. It's not just cancer, but he has talked to lots of people with cancer, but also people who've it's happened because of a war or something like that. And the great thing about this is that it's bringing it out the closet as being something that happens to a few rare enlightened beings, to show that actually a genuine transformation can happen to anybody without any background whatsoever in sort of spirituality or having no ideas about it's, you know, something they're looking for even. It can still happen to those people. And so it's actually available to anybody who's open and ready for change, basically.
Yeah, and I think for different people, the level of suffering that's required for them to actually address their life varies.
Right.
And you know, if I look back at my own situation, I reckon I got half a dozen warnings from my life that I need to look at the direction I was going in. And I was just too busy or too hard-headed, or, you know, I thought, oh, I'll deal with, you know, what's really important in my life when I'm nice and comfortable and all set up and got the time. I think that's it. That it's just a reality that for many of us, it is actually suffering that provides the pathway to looking into what our life's really about, and then actually pursuing what techniques, what things we can do to actually affect the changes in our life that would help to make it more meaningful and lead us to be more content.
Mm. Yeah, I kind of think of it as the human condition to not change unless you absolutely have to. You know, rare is the being who changes at the first call. That just seems normal to me you know, understandable too. People don't want to change particularly, so they won't if they don't feel they absolutely have to. So,
yeah, so I have, you know, I do quite a lot of teaching and meditation.
Right.
And again, it's often through personal suffering of some form that people come into that to start that practice.
Right.
And you know, that's a welcome entry point. But I really admire the people who just are basically well and recognise that there's more to life, and they want to look into the right. truth of who they really are, and those things, and take up the practice without having been provoked by some difficult circumstance.
Totally agree. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we're out of time. Really interesting chat. I really loved it, especially because it follows hot on the heels of our conference. It's very timely. So, you know, you've made a hugely significant contribution to the broadening of the ideas of what cancer care looks like over the last four decades. So it's been a real honour, actually, to hear from you directly about some of the stuff that you've learned along the way. So, you know, huge thanks to you for speaking to us today.
Can I just mention, Robin, because I think it's rather unique. I've been involved in developing a meditation app called Alleviate, Allevi, and then the number 8. And what we've done with that is actually link people. We got the capacity to link people up to get direct mentoring online with experienced meditation teachers. So for people who find an app useful, it's sort of taking it to another level, and it's basically aimed at supporting people with significant health issues and helping them to practice regularly. So people might find that helpful.
They might do. It's quite an area of development, finding out how you can use these kind of things to support people, isn't it? Yeah, very interesting. Okay, thank you for that. All right, well, last big thank you to you very much, Ian.
Well, more power to you too. I really appreciate what you're doing, and it's great to have been able to contribute a little, hopefully, tonight.
Definitely. Thank you. Do look up Ian's authoritative books and also the app he mentioned. Alleviate, that's spelled Allevi and the number 8, which has a website of its own at alleviate.net. Thanks so much for listening today. I hope you found the show rewarding, and we want to come back for more next week when I host another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.